Hi, I'm Jack from Twin Peaks, and you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and we're the best band in the world.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, we're coming to you streaming with Lydia Davis here in the studio. We're in like a special location here. Lydia, thanks so much for being A, game for radio, and B, in this kind of exciting, like, I feel like we're almost like a mobile unit today together.
It's beautiful here. The records all around us, old, looks like old records, beautiful collection. I can't imagine what's in here.
And there's even more behind, like in other areas of the building, behind some cages, even
really?
More like the hallways of albums.
Right.
And I can show you the CDs after too.
Okay. records are my era. And, originally.
And if there are any songs that you'd like us to play, we can also try to do our best to get them in on the breaks if any occur to you.
Okay.
Okay. As we go along. So without further ado, Lydia, you are in town as the distinguished writer in residence with the Zell Visiting Writers series. You've given a talk already, and tomorrow we've got on deck a conversation with Doug Trevor.
Yep,
does that
sound right?
That's okay. Right. Okay. And so this will be 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. At UMA in the Helmut Stern Auditorium. So tomorrow, Thursday. So everyone, folks, you can put that on your calendar. And while we're doing events, a quick shout out about a future Living Writers guest. Moha Kaff is here in town on Friday, March 23rd. Her talk, Syrian Dreams, Siren Blasts. That'll be in the Rackham Amphitheater on Friday at 4 p.m. And then Moha Kaff will be in Detroit on Saturday, March 24th at 6 p.m. at the Aliyah Hassan Auditorium in the Arab American National Museum. So those are two upcoming events, too. But today, we are so lucky to have Lydia Davis here in the studio with us. Stephanie and I are so excited. And we even, as a bonus, have Maya West sitting in as our studio audience.
Yeah,
so,
it's true.
Some good times.
Great room.
And how has it been? Because you've been here a couple of days, right, Lydia?
It's
how's
right.
it going
it's
so far?
It's supposedly not as cold as it is back home, but it feels pretty darn cold.
So are you still based in Albany?
Right near Albany, about a half hour east of Albany, a little village that's piled with snow right now.
And so are the cows inside right now?
Oh, I'm afraid the cows that I used to look out the window at went some years ago. Yeah. The place was sold and the cows went to different farms. They weren't offed quite yet, but they were removed to another home.
Well, I was thinking that was kind of you to put it that way, because as soon as you first said that, I thought
No, they might be still in the land of the living. But I do miss them a lot.
Well, I saw your edition of the cows that was also coupled with photography.
Yes.
A friend, Phoebe Nobles, brought it to NELP in 2011 and taught a class about it. And is that one of, it was interesting to me because it was one of the first books that I saw of yours that where photography was such a key component as well.
Yeah, and I'm not sure, you know, I'm always observing things, and I was observing the cows, but why wasn't it enough just to have the observations in words? And I think I just loved, it was a way of embracing them again, you know, through pictures. Most of the photos were mine, but some were my son's, some were my brother's, who also likes animals. And when he comes up to visit from the city, he would go up to the pasture and photograph them.
And the cows, they do tend to come up to you, don't they?
They do. It's not always friendly. In fact, it's probably usually not friendly. They're either curious or mainly just curious, really.
And sometimes, once I was rushed by a group of cows in a small farmland in Lopez Island, and it was frightening, quite honestly. And I got to a fence and then just sort of had to stand there. And then there was lots of slobber, too. Anyway, cows, amazing.
No, I got too close to the calf once, even though the calf was half grown. The mother didn't like that. And she did rush me, or whatever you want to call it.
Are you all right? You're here today.
I was on the other side of the fence, but it was still frightening.
Yeah, because we think of them as such docile creatures.
Yeah,
but
yeah, when their kids are involved.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like some folks I know,
right?
in a good way. And so, in Can't and Won't, Out with Picador in 2014, you have the cows is in full here, but without the images. So we do have it.
Yeah, we talked about putting photos in, but it just raises, well, it does two things. It raises the price of the book or the cost of the book for one thing, and then it also changes the nature of the book. You know, that one story would have had photos and the rest not. So
this seems, well, I was just so happy to see it in this book, since I don't have a copy of the other one yet. Well, you know, before we get too far afield here, I'll read the bio from Can't and Won't, and we'll fill in part of the pieces afterwards.
Okay.
Lydia Davis is the author of one novel and four previous story collections, including Varieties of Disturbance, which was a finalist for the 2007 National Book Award. She is the winner of the 2013 Award of Merit Medal for the short story from the American Academy of Arts and Letters and of the 2013 Man Booker International Prize. She is also the translator of Swan's Way and Madame Bovary, both of which were awarded the French-American Foundation Translation Prize. The collected stories of Lydia Davis, published in 2009, was described by James Wood in The New Yorker as a grand cumulative achievement. And you know what? And here you are still achieving, like left and right.
Well, I still keep going. It's hard for me not to keep going. Although I diversify my activities. I'm getting, like a lot of people, getting much more active politically. I started being pretty active about 4 years ago, but I'm much more so now.
What are some of the, do you mind talking about some of the more recent
activities? Well, it's mainly, I mean, I do get on one committee after another. It's sort of, once you get on one, you get fingered for another, or whatever the word would be.
Recruited, definitely.
Recruited. Right? So I got, 4 years ago, I was appointed to the village board where I live. The village is run by a board of trustees, as they call them, four trustees and one mayor. And then I ran for re-election the next term when my term was up, and I ran for re-election right this term, and the election was yesterday. But I still don't know the outcome because, strangely, the New York Times did not report it, and I didn't hear it on the radio.
No one called you?
No, I asked my husband today, but he didn't know yet either. So,
is that village life in a way?
Yeah, if you want to know, you call someone, but you know, he's not calling anyone.
You'll be home.
I'm not worried because I ran unopposed, as I did last time.
Okay.
And unless there was a big campaign to write in a different candidate, I probably got the seat again.
And does it feel good to be able to be, I don't know, have direct agency? Because
yes.
I think after this last election, it felt important to try to do something, no matter what it was, every week, even if it was something small. I don't have a political office.
I originally agreed to be on the board, serve on the board, because I loved the idea of having a say in what went on in my village. And I don't think people realize how simple it is in a way, you know, that you can go to the monthly meetings of whatever it is, your village board or your town board or your whatever the government is, and you can at least see what they're saying and what's going on. And there's always a public hearing, public comment time, I should say. Mm-hmm. So you can stand up and say, well, the intersection of Maple and Washington is very dangerous, and it has been for years. Why isn't anything done about it? And you can and it has to go in the minutes, and they have to think about it for
so
at least
a minute.
So
it's on the record.
It's on the record. But even more simply, you can run for office if you want, because a lot of people don't want to. So, you know, you have a good chance of holding office and taking part. And I find it fascinating. I'm not tired of it after 2 years.
And is it something that is also feeding your imaginative life, too?
Yeah, well, it's feeding. I have many, many different interests. Of course, it's feeding my interest in human nature, because I'm watching how people deal with each other, how people deal with issues, how they handle their lives, and what you can do, what you can't do. But I'm also artistically, so to speak, I'm never completely shut down. So, like, I wrote a story recently called Two Mayors and a Word, because our present mayor and our past mayor were sort of disagreeing about the use of the word irregardless. So I haven't shut down that part of me, even though I'm functioning as a board member.
I'm very relieved to hear that. I can't tell you how relieved. Reading Canton Woat, I felt like it was such a joy. It was something I felt like I needed. It had been a while since I had, I guess since maybe 2009.
It's been 5 years since the collected stories came out. And even those were just collected. There wasn't anything new. So I think it had been 7 years since a new book, brand new book.
And dreams figure into, well, actually, quick question before, and then maybe we could talk more about Can't and Won't.
Yeah.
What does that mean for a book on deck? If that's not too...
You mean what's up next?
Yeah, if that's not too...
Well, there are a couple of things up next. I'm supposed to be pulling together a book of essays. I've written many, many essays over the years, and I've never had a book of essays. So I'm collecting the essays and right now going through each one and making sure it's the way I want it to be.
And is this just spanning...
There'll be two volumes eventually, and the two volumes together, I think the earliest essay is maybe in the early 80s or something.
And is that when you moved back from France then? Were you back in the States?
No, I moved back from France in 74.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, the book of essays I'm supposed to be working on, but in the meantime, I keep writing stories, so I think pretty soon after that, there'll be another book of stories.
Yeah. That sounds good to me.
Yeah.
So let's see. So just to remind folks, you can go and see Lydia Davis tomorrow at UMA in conversation with Doug Trevor. Let's see, in the Helmut Stern Auditorium, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. And you did a reading yesterday.
Yes,
Lydia. And what's it been like being in Ann Arbor? Is this a return visit or is this a first time?
It's first time in Ann Arbor itself. Last summer, I was in Detroit I took part in a reading series called Nomad. It's a new reading series that specifically aims to take readings into immigrant communities. So this was, we were in the Muslim community in Detroit. And this is run by Stephanie Jean, to pronounce her name correctly. She started this reading series. I think I was in the first event. And this will continue as far as I know.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
And what time of year should we look for that around? Is it,
I don't know when the next one is.
Nomad, right?
Look
Nomad,
for Nomad
Detroit. Okay.
Yeah.
Today on the program, Lydia Davis is here. We've got her book, Can't and Won't Stories, on the table with us here, and the collected stories. We'll take a short break and we'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. Today on the program, Lydia Davis is here. And we've been talking about cows.
Yes.
And villages. Mm-hmm. And do you think, why do you think it was that you went to the village? Is it anything related to being out in rural France when you were in your 20s, do you think?
It's related to, it's very consistent with my life, really, because I was always an outdoor girl until we moved to New York City, which was kind of traumatic when I was 10. But then my parents, in their wisdom, it really was wisdom this time, not everything they did was wise, but they sent me off to boarding school when I was 15, and I went to the Putney School in Vermont. And I just loved being out on the Vermont mountaintop,
the Green Mountains,
most of the year. Yeah, it really was wonderful, and I appreciated every second of that. You know, the landscape and the outdoors, and so I've always liked being in nature. I love New York City too, but I'm happy where I am.
Was the New York City, was that something that then also grows on you? So where it becomes part of who you are, where the other feels more like a natural rejuvenation?
The progression was sort of small town, Northampton, which is an interesting town, and then big city, New York City, and then country, and then always back to New York City. I went to college in New York City. And if I moved away, I eventually moved back. It was sort of like a rubber band or a magnet or something. And I do love the city, but I'm happy being surrounded by trees and insects and animals, coyotes.
Really? Some coyotes?
Oh, yeah.
Too?
Yeah. Yep. They sound like children. Children in a playground in the distance. So it's not like a wolf howl. It's like yup, 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 like lots of people talking or something.
Right. So kind of companionable and not in a threatening way.
I don't know if it's it's not really. They're being companionable with each other, but it feels eerie. It's you know, what you hear in the middle of the night out in the country is pretty eerie. Whether it's sometimes you get a weird fox calls also, and then of course owls and all sorts of things.
Are you a night person? Are you sort of a? It sounds like you're observing through the night, or is this just a few?
Yeah, if I happen to wake up or happen to be up late. I'm a burn the candle at both ends kind of person, up late and up early.
And then maybe catch a nap somewhere in there or just read, right?
Sometimes nap, yeah.
We played the Spring by Vivaldi because somewhere in my reading about you was this idea that your first love was violins. Is that one of those things that's like, I don't know.
It's like the
random question,
whisper game or telephone game or whatever it is, where things get slightly distorted as they go around the room. Because it's true that one of my great loves, or maybe the first love, was music. But the violin itself was kind of a torment. I studied it for many years, but I never felt comfortable with it and I never got very good at it. I was better at the piano, actually. So I love Vivaldi, though.
Okay. So Lydia, let's talk. Would you mind reading something?
I'd be happy to.
Just now? Yeah. And do you, I don't know, we could play roulette with opening.
You could open at random and see what happens.
Anything. And we have got these two books here. Okay.
Well, yeah, let me give the, I'll take the more recent one. And open almost at random.
This is exciting.
I opened to the cows, of course, but that's a longer one. I'll read, this is a kind of strange one in terms of the sounds. So I'll read this one. It's called Notes During Long Phone Conversation with Mother. For summer, she needs pretty dress. Cotton, nuttock, kunt, takunt, tunkta, tucknot, tuckant, tuckton, kantot. And I could tell you a little bit that came about sort of precisely the way you might think that I was talking to my mother, and she did start by saying she needed a cotton dress. And then I guess I was slightly bored by the conversation as it went on. So I did start playing around with the letters in the word cotton to see what I could
find. And these are then also some notes that you're literally jotting down. And then...
Right. Then I made it into a sort of self-contained story.
It's interesting to think about the sound quality, how it affects the pieces. And so when you're making them, when you're drafting them, at what point are you ever saying it out loud as well? Or what's it like?
I don't ever read my stories out loud unless I'm actually just timing them for a reading. So I hear them in my head, and I hear them very distinctly in my head. Only sometimes when I actually read them out loud at a reading, then I hear more. And say, oh, I didn't catch that little echo that I don't like, you know, and then I'll change it. But sound is very important to me, but it all takes place inside my head.
Because I'm remembering, this isn't going in the Wayback Machine right now, Lydia, 2003, Seattle, you go to Richard Hugo House. So I met you briefly before.
Oh, really? That's funny.
It was now for a quick episode of This Is Your Life, but a very small part of your life,
yeah.
More my life, I guess. Sorry, folks. But you came to Hugo House and did like a 2-hour sort of class with people, and I was lucky enough to be in it since I was the registrar, so I had a little bit of leg up on the registering for it. And it was. One of the things I submitted when I even came to Michigan. So it was this really lovely turning point, this that you were like, you wrote that this week? And I said, yes. And it was very nice.
Oh, good.
So thank you for that.
That's lovely.
But I really remember also you reading in the Black Box Theater there, The Mown Lawn, which we have in the collected here. And that's one of those pieces where watching even some of my students read it, it's almost impossible to read through it. You almost start laughing, even though there's such serious intention within the piece as well.
Yeah.
I don't know. Would you feel like reading that one?
Sure.
I know that I said I wasn't going to ask for any in particular.
I should say that if I can look for it and talk at the same time, which is doubtful, but I should say that at that same reading, the Black Box, let's see, I'm going to ask someone else.
Oh,
to,
I think you
look for it, and I'll tell this.
But I'm
speaking of conjunctions of past and present. But after that reading at the Black Box, this very handsome man came up to me afterwards, and he identified himself as a kid I had known when I was a kid on Cape Cod. He was younger, but not impossibly younger. He was about 8 or 9 years younger. What was he? Anyway, 10 years younger. But he had been the little boy that I took care of with his brother and sister. And I knew the family very well. And there he made mandolins, and he always listened to the radio as he made his mandolins. So he had heard that I was going to be in town reading.
Isn't
that funny?
And so he came to see you.
He came. Yeah, it was wonderful.
That is wonderful.
Yeah.
Those moments, that's what life is when it's the best.
Yeah. I had the same thing happen in, I think it was in Zurich. I gave a reading, and a woman came up afterwards, and she had been my babysitter back when I was, say, 8 or 9 years old. She had come over from Austria. I think she's Austrian, and come over from Austria and lived with our family for a while. She turned up at a reading.
That
it was fun.
That is amazing. Okay, so I've managed to find a Mown Lawn.
Good.
So here, let's.
Okay. I used to say this is my only political piece, and it may still be my only political piece, but even though my political life has broadened out.
And we know there's more coming down the pipe.
We'll see. Well, the one about the two mayors. And the... A Mown Lawn, this is called A Mown Lawn. She hated a mown lawn. Maybe that was because mow was the reverse of wham, the beginning of the name of what she was, a woman. A mown lawn had a sad sound to it, like a long moan. From her, a mown lawn made a long moan. Lawn had some of the letters of man, though the reverse of man would be nam, a bad war. A raw war. Lawn also contained the letters of law. In fact, lawn was a contraction of lawman. Certainly a lawman could and did mow a lawn. Law and order could be seen as starting from lawn order, valued by so many Americans. More lawn could be made using a lawnmower. A lawnmower did make more lawn. More lawn was a contraction of more lawmen. Did more lawn in America make more lawmen in America? Did more lawn make more nam? More mown lawn made more long moan from her, or a lawn mourn. So often she said Americans wanted more mown lawn. All of America might be one long mown lawn. A lawn, not moan, grows long, she said. Better a long lawn, better a long lawn and a mole. Let the lawman have the mown lawn, she said, or the moron, the lawn moron. I had fun with that one. And as I've been saying today earlier to some of the students I met with, I don't plan things in advance. I don't plan stories in advance most of the time. So this was really just a riff on the idea of mowing your lawn, and all the wordplay came into it just naturally. But if I try to analyze it after the fact, I would say that the play with language probably reflects my frustration with the mown lawns and the NAM and the lawmen and lawn order and my feeling that I can't do anything about it. So here I'll just sit here and play with the words because I can't do anything about it.
And what do you think about that? Like how the lawn moron came at the end?
Right.
Because that is a true kicker. And I'm so glad that you're able to deliver it without laughing, too.
Well, I guess I've done laughing over it. I don't know. I'm laughing now. But no, I don't. I deliver it straight, like a, I don't know. You deliver the comic line straight.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll be right back with more, with a conversation with Lydia Davis today on Living Writers. You just heard The Mown Lawn out of the collected stories of Lydia Davis. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie here at the engineering board. We'll take a short break and be back.
Je me baladais sur l'avenue, le cœur ouvert à l'inconnu. J'avais envie de dire bonjour à n'importe qui, et ce fut toi. Je t'ai dit n'importe quoi, il suffisait de te parler pour t'apprivoiser. Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées, au soleil, sous la pluie. À midi ou à minuit, il y a tout ce que vous voulez aux Champs-Élysées. Tu m'as dit, j'ai rendez-vous dans un sous-sol avec des fous qui vivent la guitare à la main du soir au matin. Alors je t'ai accompagné, on a chanté, on a dansé et l'on n'a même pas pensé à s'embrasser. Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées, au soleil, sous la pluie, à midi ou à minuit, il y a tout ce que vous voulez aux Champs-Élysées. Soir, deux inconnus, et ce matin sur l'avenue, deux amoureux tout étourdis par la longue nuit. Et de l'étoile à la concorde, un orchestre a mis le corps, tous les oiseaux du point du jour chantent l'amour. Aux Champs-Élysées.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Lydia Davis is here in the studio. That's a great day indeed. And you can go in and see Lydia Davis in action, hear a conversation with Lydia Davis and Doug Trevor tomorrow at UMA in the Helmut Stern Auditorium at, 5:30. So,
okay.
We'll put that on the calendars. Talking a little bit more now about can't and won't. There's many... many short pieces in here that come from dreams, yeah. Yours and others.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why the dreams for this collection.
Well, I hadn't been all that interested in dreams before. You know how some people obsessively write down their dreams and they have a little dream journal or dream diary, and I had not been one of those people, partly because it takes so long to describe a dream in detail. It's kind of a chore. And then I began to see the possibilities of not recording faithfully every bit of a dream, but just making it into a story, taking the parts of it that lent themselves to being a story. And I don't mean fictionalizing around the dream, but just taking actually what happened in the dream, no matter how vestigial, no matter how minimal, and writing it in such a way that it would have some impact, either imagistically or narratively. And at the same time, I had the idea of taking real waking experiences and writing them as though they were dreams, narrating them as though they were dreams. Like for this experience today, I could say, you know, I'm in a room filled with records. There are records everywhere I look. There are, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There are strange colored lights on the ceiling. So that you could be in a dream.
That surreal quality.
Yeah, the surreal, you pick and choose what is surreal about the experiences. And then I widened the net a little and thought, well, if friends want to tell me their dreams, I can see if I can make a story out of them. And if friends want to tell me waking experiences that are like dreams, I can also make a little dream-like story out of those. And I liked not identifying which were real and which were dreams.
And they're sewn throughout, too.
Yes,
it's not as if they're there a section or so.
Yeah, there are about, I don't know, 24, 28 of them. I can't remember. There are lots.
And so it was something that felt also fun and fruitful.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know.
Yeah. And I did write lots of them. And a friend told me about an experience she'd had in her local bank that was very dreamlike.
Is that what started it off? Because that's what I was going to ask you, if the bank one and two, if those were...
They didn't start it off, but as soon as she told me about this experience, she didn't know I was doing this project. I said, I started pinning her down, you know, exactly what prizes did they offer you and so on. And she began to smell a rat because she's a writer, too. She's a poet, Rachel Haddis. And she said, are you writing? I know what she said. She said she answered my questions about what were the details that were missing. And then she said, and feel free to use it. So she knew what I was doing. And then because she knew I had made a story out of it, that she then reported the next experience at the bank. So that's at the bank.
Because she did have,
she had
like
another,
genuinely another bank
another
dream.
And it's all true, you know, everything that I say in the story.
It's maybe, can we talk a little bit about truth, like in stories? Because I think, so you wrote a piece for The New Yorker, and I'm thinking, imagining it might be in your collected essays, it's going to be coming out, Lucia Berlin, the short story writer.
Yeah, it'll be in there. Yeah.
And so she sounds like, reading that piece, it was inspiring. I want to now read her.
Oh, she's a wonderful writer. Lucia Berlin.
And you've it seems like, I don't know, she was important to you in your work?
Well, or not. She and I did not so much influence each other as simply we were each other's fan clubs, you know. I mean, I really loved her stories. And she's getting the attention now since Farrar Straus published her, I guess it's a selected stories, about a year and a half ago. She's getting the attention now I thought she should have had decades ago. You know, she was really right up there with the best writers, and she didn't get that attention. So I was always very frustrated about it, whereas she was more philosophical and didn't want to make a big effort to, you know, get that kind of major publicity. So I'm very glad she's getting it now, because her stories are wonderful.
And well, it seems like, I guess it was after her death then, that this kind of publicity.
Well, it took a while, because she died in 2004, and this didn't
happen. On her birthday.
I guess so.
Well, that's what you wrote, so I believe you.
I guess
you.
If I wrote it,
it must be
it
true.
True.
Yeah. Talking about truth, right?
Yeah, so we never met, actually, but we corresponded for about 20, 25 years.
So a relationship through the letters and correspondence.
Yeah, she wasn't very mobile because she was in such bad health a lot of the time. At the end, she had to have an oxygen tank and things like that. I almost got to where she was living, but it didn't work out in Colorado. She didn't die there. She died on the West Coast. But so I'm sorry I never met her, but she left behind wonderful stories.
And it seems like to her that would be something, it seems like from reading your piece, that was what mattered too. The story's the thing.
Yep. Yeah.
and I wonder how, like, I feel like that's something, like, how do you engage with that, Lydia, this idea of like working with this idea of like there might be things that come out of your own, you know, own life, your own observations, right? The mayor's,
right.
For example. But and what's true, because what the story makes then is the truth. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, certainly a story, although, you know, we call it fiction, it can be anything from the absolute truth. Or I shouldn't say truth, because as soon as you start selecting from an experience and retelling it, even if every single bit of it happened, the fact that you selected it and the way you select it puts a certain slant on it. So, but a story can run all the way from, you know, based on actual fact entirely to being entirely made up, of course. And I guess I like to be somewhere on the toward the real end of it, but always feeling free to fictionalize, to put in something that isn't true. If someone was tall, to make them short, and vice versa. In fact, a man came up last night after the reading and said, I'm very interested in the change from the story when it was published in the magazine to when it was published in your book, because in the magazine, the woman was tall, and in the book, she's short. And so I had to explain why I made that change, because you go through for a final change before you put something in a book. But anyway, I'd like the freedom to be able to mix in fiction with fact. I think a lot of Lucia Berlin's stories had a lot of her life in them, but I think almost all of them also had a lot of fiction in them, according to her.
And it's like in her family too, right? That's not exactly how it happened, but
right.
But maybe it becomes like what the story becomes its own thing.
Yeah, the story in the end is what's left. You know, it doesn't really matter in the end, and it won't matter.
And even the word, I don't know, thinking about categories, I never like them. But thinking about the word story and what it can encompass.
Of course, the word story by itself can be fact or fiction.
Exactly. You know? So it feels like a really open word. So what, I don't know why, I sometimes get irritated when people say what you write is flash fiction, and the other terms like don't necessarily fit either. Like short shorts, it sounds funny. It sounds like a commercial for Nair or something.
Right.
I don't know.
I don't like the various terms myself. I like to call them just very short stories, or, you know, extremely short stories.
Extremely short story. Okay.
And some of the European practitioners also called them just very short prose pieces or something. So a very matter-of-fact label is what I like. But, you know, whatever people come up with is fine with me also, you know, flash, if that's here to stay, or short, you know.
Or sudden fiction.
Yeah,
or...
yeah. People try different terms, but, you know, whatever sticks, okay. I'm not going to argue with it.
Okay. I'll do the arguing for now then.
Okay.
You were influenced by Russell Edson early on, or was it?
Yeah, he was important to kind of jar me out of my, it wasn't a rut because I was still too young, but I was writing very traditional short stories and not always happy. You know, it's hard work, as anyone will agree, it's hard work to construct a conventional narrative short story that works. And it was reading his stories that made me realize, I can be wackier and shorter and crazier and, you know, more absurd and more emotional, and I can do all sorts of things. So he really broke me out of what I was doing, and that made me very happy.
And I feel like you do that for others.
Good, yeah. I get that feeling sometimes that I liberate others, which is terrific. Yeah. That's one of the happiest things I can hear from someone. The other happy thing is when they say, your story really helped me. I was in a bad relationship and so on and so forth. And so it can help in life, too, which is wonderful.
And I think that's speaking to like this recognizing something that's so real within each of these story worlds that you're creating.
Well, they're heartfelt in the sense that they come from a strong emotion. You know, sometimes the emotion is, say, delight in language or humor. Other times it's agony and, you know, or agony mixed with humor. But they come from strong emotions. They're not sort of intellectual experiments. You know, they're based in emotion.
Let's talk more about that after the break. Today on Living Writers, Lydia Davis is here. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be right back.
Picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came, Father Mackenzie, wiping the dirt from his hands as he walks from the grave. No one was saved, all alone. Where do they all come from?
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, really glad you did. Today on the program, Lydia Davis is here in the studio. Thanks for picking the Eleanor Rigby,
Lydia. I love that song. I still love it after all these years.
When did you, what's the story with it?
I don't know what year it came out, but I was a teenager and I just, maybe I loved it, not only because it's a lovely song, but it has all the stringed instruments in it. So I always loved their combination of rock and sort of classical, you know, orchestration, if you will.
It feels like such a big piece, too, doesn't it? Like it's enveloping.
It's so sad in a kind of soppy way. And, you know,
All
the lonely people. It's charming.
Well, thanks for picking it for today. So before the break, we were talking about the emotional source of it, like for the piece, like when you're generating them as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, writing matters to me. I don't want to write something that doesn't matter to me. So but that's not to say that they're all generated by these profound sentiments of loss or grief, a lot of them are generated by delight or fun, you know, possibilities of like one of the ones I read last night about an incident. It's called The Incident on the Train, in which, you know, one thing leads to another, to another, to another, until the whole car is upset and everybody's upset. But it's funny. Delight or delight in language. The one about the two mayors and the word irregardless was about language.
Do you have any that you you memorize, like of your, maybe even your shorter pieces that you...
I can recite some of them, but I'm always afraid I don't have it quite right. And I usually don't have it quite right. So I'm really tied to the text person.
Me too.
I can't recite the Two Mayors one, unfortunately. But it'll be in the next book, whenever that is.
So we'll stay tuned for that. Could you talk a little bit about the interiority of what I feel like is the voice on the page?
Well, yeah.
Or not.
It's my voice in my head, I suppose. Or I slip into the persona of the narrator. So it's not quite me, actually. I guess it's me when I'm writing an essay. That's me speaking. When I'm writing fiction, it's not quite me. Often it's a she, and it's a character outside myself. And then other times when it's close to my life, it's still not quite me. Again, because I'm selecting. It's, you know, I'm not as obsessed as my narrators, and I'm not as earnest as my narrators sometimes are.
That's reminding me of from Can't and Won't, the fish.
Yeah.
The dinner, is it? Or is it the fish restaurant? Or...
There are a few fish ones, just as there are.
Eating fish alone.
Eating fish alone. Yes.
I was thinking of. Because that's one of those ones where it seems so observational and particular.
Yeah.
But then it also is so recognizable. As I read through it, I was like, yes, I see what you're...
it's about a woman eating fish by herself in a restaurant and thinking about the chef and about the food on her plate and the vegetables and how she should have eaten more of the fish so as not to offend the chef. But the funny thing is that it was based on a meal that I ate not alone, but with my husband. I'd really preferred to make it alone because it was simpler. It simplified things. And so that's where fiction would come in. Say the meal actually was with my husband and he was eating meat and I was eating fish and so on. And a lot of what happens in the story happened during our dinner. And a lot of the feelings, my feeling afterwards that I should have had all the fish so as not to offend the chef. But I wasn't alone.
But there is, like, by making that choice in the story, mm-hmm. that gives it another level of pathos, definitely.
Yes. Yes. And of course, certain elements in there, I say generally certain things about, you know, when I'm eating alone, I like to read, but I like to sit in a good light. And all that is true. And I have eaten many restaurant meals alone with a good light and a book. You know? I love to do that.
Well, could we switch gears a little bit to talk about translation?
Sure.
Because in one way, I was thinking the pieces in, well, let me ask you, in mm-hmm. Can't and Won't, because Flaubert? Am I pronouncing the name correctly?
That's right.
So the pieces also similar to the dreams, Flaubert, there are pieces that run through.
Yeah, there are 13 stories from Flaubert and one rant from Flaubert because he was a great one for ranting about things.
Can you talk a little bit about how Flaubert made his way into Can't and Won't?
Yeah, I was translating Madame Bovary and it was a project of 2 or 3 years, as I remember. And in the course of it, I would read his letters because he wrote letters to his lover, Louise Collet, who was a poet. She lived in Paris. He lived down in Rouen, outside of Rouen. And he would write letters to her describing how the book was coming. So, of course, the letters were very useful to me just to see his perspective on what he was doing. And also to see how he wrote when he was writing a letter as opposed to a novel. And not correcting it, presumably. I don't think he had time to copy over the letter because he would write it, you know, at the end of his workday. So that would be 1 or 2 in the morning. But in the course of these letters, I found these beautiful little self-contained anecdotes that he was telling her or... anecdotes or just reports on his life. He went to a funeral the day before, and then another letter would talk more about the woman who died and so on. And I began to see these as beautiful little stories that should exist on their own. So I took them out of the letters and shaped them a little bit, but just a little bit, and so I could present them as stories, but not my stories. They're really Flaubert's stories, but I facilitated them. I'm the midwife for these stories.
And when you're shaping them for this, how is that? Because that seems very different to me than when you were working on Madame Bovary.
When I'm translating, especially a book like Madame Bovary, I stay extremely close to the original, just as close as I can, and as faithful as I can. But when I'm shaping the story, of course, I'm doing something very different. I'm making it into something else. So I feel free to combine sentences or separate sentences or cut sentences or change the wording a little bit. And sometimes I would add a little fact. I would look up something and add a little fact to it. In general, I didn't want to touch it more than I had to, but I would do just the bare necessity.
And it's interesting to think about how, in a way, you make these rules for yourself,
right?
To make these worlds with Flaubert or the dreams. Or
you can say the story itself is making the rule. It's sort of telling me what it needs to be and do, what I need to do, the demands of the story.
And that's hard to articulate in some ways, isn't it?
Well, it's you have to sense, you know, when you're confronted with sort of fertile, interesting, rich material, you have to sense, you know, how does it want to, what form does it want to take? Does it want to be a really quick little thing, or does it want to be something in depth and dense and protracted? You know, and then you sort of start working on it intuitively, and then you kind of try to pick up what are the rules that it's making now as I intuitively make it, write it. It's complicated.
Because it's becoming.
Yeah, it's coming into being, and it's not, and that's why I don't like to plan ahead too much.
Lydia Davis, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Come back anytime, would
thank
you?
Thank you. I will.
And I think we're going to go out on another Beatles song. Is it Yellow Submarine, Stephanie? Okay.
Okay, good.
So we'll go out
I feel at home.
Exactly. And we're sort of upbeat. And tomorrow, Thursday, Lydia Davis will be in conversation with Doug Trevor at UMA, 5:30 p.m. Thanks, everyone, for listening out there. Thanks to Steph for engineering. Lydia Davis, thanks so much. Thanks, Maya, for coming by. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
In the town where I was born, lived a man who sailed to sea. And he told us of his life in the land of submarines. So we sailed on to the sun till we found the sea of green, and we lived beneath the waves in our yellow submarine. We all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine.
Listening to WCBN FM, Ann Arbor.
Radio Free Ann Arbor. 24 hours a day.
Yeah, it sounds all right. Bring it up a little bit. Yeah, let's do it that way. Testing. 1, 2, 3.